Oh yeah, getting in the mood as we talk about 1975.
Lady, when you're with me, I'm smiling.
Dennis DeYoung and Styx riding high on the charts, and in Major League Baseball, one of the great World Series of all time between the Red Sox and the Cincinnati Reds. And those Cincinnati Reds, the topic of discussion today on Sports Lit 101 with Bruce Pratts.
Yeah, we're going to talk about a book today that's from a series from SABR, the Society for American Baseball Research, on memorable baseball teams. And this is not the only one of them. I don't have the whole list of them. And they partnered up with the University of Nebraska Press, whose books we often talk about and is the premier sports publishing press. And it's edited by a guy named Mark Armour. And what they did was they selected the general manager, the coaches, the players, and the and Marty Brenneman, the longtime broadcaster, and had different people write short biographies of them relating to 1975. And I've always argued, and I mentioned this earlier, that I think the best Red Sox team of all time, of my lifetime, was 1975. As you mentioned, had Jim Rice been healthy, wow, who knows how far they could have gone. And there are plenty of intelligent baseball historians who would argue that the 75 Cincinnati Reds was the best eight-man starting lineup since the 1927 Yankees. So people that are wiser than me in these sports things have contributed to this, but this book is really cool because the way it's set up. It starts out with an introduction, as most of them do. Then the first chapter is on Bob Housem. Now, that's not a household name, but without Bob Housem, there's no 75 Reds.
Right.
He came over, became the general manager. He had experience in St. Louis and in Pittsburgh. The first thing he did was build their scouting system up, and he learned how to do that because he had originally worked for Branch Rickey. So you see this connection to 1975 that goes all the way back into the 40s when Rickey was developing the Dodgers' notoriously great farm team. And you get this idea from Housem that he knew that scouting and player development was the future. And in the second chapter deals with that. And just a quick look at the people who were signed or drafted under this time, and beginning with just before Housem, were Pete Rose, Tony Perez, Johnny Bench, Bernie Carbo, Gary Nolan, Daryl Chaney, Davey Concepcion, Ross Grimsey, Don Gullett, Raleigh Eastwood, Ken Griffey, and Dan Dreesen. Now, that stocking of the Cincinnati Reds team allowed them to do something else, and that's make the famous trade that brought Joe Morgan from the Astros to the Reds. And is the trade that most people who write about these things, and I did some other research because I didn't want to just look at this book, say was that was the glue. Once they got Morgan, they were off and running. And when you think about the teams that the Reds beat or played on a regular basis in the World Series, we're talking about some really great Yankees teams and a really great Red Sox team. So when you look at that period of time from, say, 75 to maybe 1980, you're looking at an era where the top teams in baseball were really good. But what I like that the authors did was they started out with Sparky Anderson. And, you know, I sort of knew who Sparky – I mean, I knew who Sparky Anderson was. I knew he was a colorful sort of guy. I had no idea of how hard he worked to get to be a big league manager. And when he got there, he hired guys, with the exception of Alex Gramas and Ted Kluszewski, who had successful major league careers. He hired career minor league guys who had never been able to get to the show to work on his coaching staff, which included, and I think this is a guy who I found more fascinating than just about anybody I read about, who was 45 years in the game before he got into the majors, was his bench coach, George Sherger. This book would be worth it just for the story of George Sherger's life. He managed everywhere. He was a pitching coach everywhere. And every time it looks like he's going to get a shot, something like World War II comes along and things get changed for him. You talk a lot about the role that Larry Shepard played as a coach and the role that Ted Kluszewski played a man who was long before Bill Belichick was cutting the sleeves off his sweatshirt, had to cut the sleeves off his jersey because his biceps were so big.
And, you know, you mentioned Sparky Anderson, too. And because he was prematurely gray, people thought he was much older than he was. He was only 41 in 1975.
Yes. And he had been essentially managing in baseball or coaching in professional baseball since he was about 26, when it was became clear he wasn't going to make it as a player. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating is how Anderson never forgot great advice from people he got when he was starting out. And when he was able to bring them on his team, he did that immediately. And, you know, he was old school. You know, you shave every day, wear coats and ties, this and that. And that had not been the, you know, he was very much sort of the mold the Yankees were at that time. But somehow the players got on board with him. But when the authors talked to the players, whether it was a Merv Rettman or a Clay Carroll or Terry Crowley, you know, somebody that, Ed Armbrister, someone who wasn't a star, they talked about the way that Sparky always kept them in the game, kept them part of what was going, way it was going on. So the way the book is structured, I think this is cool. After the introduction, they go through the management. Then they have the preseason outlook. And then they go through a number of players, Pete Rose, Tom Hall, Bill Plummer, Dom Gullett, and some others. And then they give you a synopsis of what happened in April. Go through more players, do it for May. Go through more, do it for June. Go through more, do it for July. And on up to the end of the season. So you not only get a biography of each player, but you get how each player performed in those particular months. I mean, this is a book that, you know, is almost coffee table size and is about 260 pages long. Well, there's a lot of notes, maybe about 240 pages of text. And you sort of reading along, and then suddenly you realize, man, half these guys are in the Hall of Fame.
Well, yeah. And you look at
a loaded team.
You look at the numbers, too, and nobody had an out-of-character year. Nobody on the team had more than the 28 home runs that Johnny Bench hit. But they were a team built for the times and built for their stadium, too, at Riverfront, a team built on speed and defense. They had 4 300 hitters in the starting lineup, but they also had 6 guys who stole at least 10 bases, led by Joe Morgan with 67 and David Concepcion with 33.
Right, and people forget that in those days, Rose was stealing bases, and Anderson, you know, he was known as Captain Hook. He wasn't afraid to go to the bullpen. He trusted his staff and his players, but he apparently was always willing to turn guys loose, you know. And I remember watching the interview with where they played in the playoffs that year, and it's going to escape me now. Before the World Series, and the guy said they are built for this park. They know how to play in this park. But you look, their road record was pretty darn good too. But, you know, they were built for that time, the 70s, you know, big hair and plastic grass and all that. When AstroTurf and speed were part of the game, they had both that and power.
And they had a great pitching staff, again, made up of no superstars, but a great combination of young talent and journeymen who prospered under Sparky Anderson. You had Gary Nolan at 27 and Jack Billingham at 32, both won 15 games. Young Don Gullett at 24 was a 15-game winner. You had, again, 6 different guys who had at least 10 victories that year.
Yeah, and they talk a lot about how Anderson was really good at managing the older players in a way that encouraged them to mentor the younger players. One of the things I found really interesting about this was the way that the team was built. Whenever there was a need, because they had so much talent in the minors and they'd done such a good job, they could trade people without giving up big pieces. And they were able to trade people that most teams wouldn't have traded because they had either somebody coming up behind them or they were so deep. And one of the reasons, of course, was this is before free agency became what it became. you know, the veteran relievers, Pedro Bourbon, Clay Carroll, Raleigh Eastwick, and Will McEnany, when they got to the World Series, those four guys were good. And they, you know, really outside of Bourbon, you don't think of any of the three of them, of the other three, as being stars.
And that 75 team, I had forgotten this until I did a little research before our conversation today. They won 108 games in the regular season.
Yeah, and they started out a house on fire. I think they went like 23-6 to start or something, and it was, you know, appeared to be pretty much over at that point. The other really cool thing is there was the loyalty that both the Reds organization and Anderson showed to players and coaches. You know, it's a cutthroat business, and I'm certainly not going to give Marge Schott much credit for being a good human being. But you look at the people that they were able to get into the fold. A guy like Larry Shepard, who, you know, prepared such players as a minor league manager as Don Clendenin, Steve Blass, Doc Ellis, Manny Sanguian, Manny Mota, Wilbur Wood, and Willie Stargell. So he mentored a lot of good players. Anderson knew he was a good mentor, knew he'd be good for him, and he lured him away. And the Reds were willing to do that. They were willing to pay a little more to get a coach that Sparky thought would help and fit the team. And you got to give him a lot of credit for that, too.
It's interesting how the game has changed when you look at the bullpen numbers. I'm looking at the 1976 stats right now. And again, no one in those days, teams didn't usually have a closer. They'd have a crew of relievers and they would do the job and often go 2-3 innings at the end of a game. But their top two relievers, Raleigh Eastwick in 1976, had 11 wins, 26 saves, and pitched 107 innings. And Pedro Bourbon, 4 wins, 8 saves, and threw 121 innings of relief.
Yeah. You know, I was trying to remember when in what year it was, the second year that Sparky Lyle was with the Yankees. He and Lindy McDaniel had, I don't know, 20 some wins between them, and each had well over 100 innings. And it was like, yeah, that's what happens. Now, I don't know the last time a reliever had 100 innings. Who had any number of real decisions.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I don't recall many in recent years that have had much more than, you know, 75 or 80.
Yeah, I mean that's what I was thinking. One of the couple of really neat things in here at the end is a lot of stuff about Marty Brenneman and how he called him like he saw him, and he sometimes angered players and angered management. And at one point, the general manager was all set to hang him and let him go, and he hated him and this and that. So the organization fired the general manager instead because they felt that Brenneman, what he was saying about the team, was accurate. you don't see that many broadcasters have that kind of an influence on the way the team is done. But, you know, you look at some of these guys and you forget what Foster, I think his career high was 53 home runs in one season or something along those lines.
He was the only player to hit 50 home runs in a season in the entire decade of the 70s.
Right. That's what I thought. I was going to ask you if that, because I knew you would know that off the top of your head. You know, they were players that they would say to them, look, you don't have to hit the ball out of the ballpark. Bench was one of them. That they liked Bench putting the ball in play. Great if he hit a home run, fine. But they weren't trying to do, you know, that sort of the Earl Weaver, give me a 3-run home run in the eighth. They were trying to play a complete game of baseball, and both Anderson and Sugar and Klazuski and the other coaches are credited with being able to do that because Sparky let the coaches do their job. He wouldn't overrule a third base coach or a first base coach. He wouldn't second guess him in the press. He wouldn't say, well, he shouldn't have waved him home. He didn't do that. And as a result, the loyalty that he built up seems to have really sort of sloughed its skin off onto the players. And they you know, they don't seem to have had many internecine squabbles between guys on the team. And you got some huge egos in there. You know, I mean, Pete Rose for starters. But Joe Morgan admitted that as a player, he had a pretty healthy ego. But they, you know, they, you know, I was, it was, they were the National League. I'm an American League guy, and like you said, it wasn't a team you could hate. Even I mean, I remember rooting very hard in '75 for the Red Sox to win because I'm an American League guy. I had a lot of friends who were Red Sox fans, and like I liked the people on that team. I was always a big fan of Rick Miller, you know, I look back and I think, man, they lost to what could be the best team of the last 50 years.
And, you know, there's a nice little Red Sox connection, too, and a Maine connection. People may not remember this, but Ken Coleman, the longtime Red Sox broadcaster, actually went to Cincinnati in 1975 and for three or four seasons was their primary broadcaster along with Brenneman. And the director of broadcast operations that hired Ken Coleman was a guy named Jim Winters, who was a legendary broadcaster here in Maine at WABI in the late 50s and early 60s. George Hale would remember the exact tenure he was there, but there was a nice Maine and Sox connection before Coleman returned to the Red Sox for the 1979 season.
Yeah, and I think that's what's really fascinating about the Cincinnati team. They were held together for a pretty long period of time, given the post-free agency era. But there are a lot of people who stayed in the organization in one way or another, even after they stopped playing, or came back. As furious as Darryl Johnson and Tony Kubek and Kirk Gowdy and Carlton Fisk were about the Armbrister collision. You know, they basically, when Larry Barnett said, hey, it was a collision, it was part of going to first base, people were angry, but they got back to baseball. You know, people aren't talking about that the way they talk about, oh, we got jobbed on this, or that was pass interference. And I think that was because both teams were so compelling to watch. And you know, think about Carbo's home run that helps it get to Game 7, Fisk's home run that gets it to Game 7, you know, Morgan's catch. There are so many moments from that World Series that here we are 45 years later, we're still talking about.
Awesome. And so, Bruce, the book again is called?
The Great Eight, the 1975 Cincinnati Reds, edited by Mark Armour, published by the Society for American Baseball Research with University of Nebraska Press.